Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, we want to get you to check out our previous podcast. Yesterday, we did a podcast about Captain America, the Winter Soldier, and we talked about basically every aspect of that movie. So, if you liked or hated that movie, check out our podcast about it. Also, follow us on Twitter at the MacGuffin Men, and you can find all of our older podcasts at themacguffinmen.com. I believe this is episode 169, so there's a lot of content out there. Anyway, let's get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
Are you still entering the ring? We're still 6 minutes away from you getting your notes.
No, I'm not the Undertaker.
Okay.
Well, as Alex so hilariously alluded to,
I am hilarious, it's true.
we're going to be talking about the WWE today.
Yes.
Once in a while, we like to talk sports, and once in a while, we like to talk sports
Yeah.
entertainment.
And we always talk entertainment, so it's a good mixture of the two.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to talk about the WWE and kind of wrestling in general and its space in pop culture and in the sports world, because it holds a very kind of unique place in both.
Yeah.
And the most recent WrestleMania 30, WrestleMania Triple X just passed. And so we thought it was time to talk about it. So with the warning that Alex and I are not diehard wrestling fans. We don't watch it, twice a week in every pay-per-view. So if you're a hardcore wrestling fan, our apologies if we get something wrong or miss something. But we kind of keep our finger on the pulse of it. And as we said, we think it's kind of a more fascinating product than one that we necessarily pay every second attention to. So
And the thing is, I think if we did pay attention to it every week, it would be much less interesting, it's kind of it's one of those things that since there's so much product, checking in every once in a while makes it way better,
Yes.
And like, although I will say I have been watching basically every Raw since the Royal Rumble and pay-per-view, and it's been a good couple months for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of something that kids around here grow up with, and then some of them slowly lose interest, and then some of them maintain that interest
Yeah.
into adulthood. But it's a big deal. The WWE, everyone knows about it. People who don't really follow it, the people who are superstars in WWE really transcend wrestling. And by that, I mean everyone knew Hulk Hogan, everyone knew Stone Cold Steve Austin. Everyone knows The Rock, even before his successful acting career. And people know, I think most people would be able to pick John Cena out of a lineup, even if they don't respect the sport at all.
Yeah, also because they'd just be pointing at him, and who is that cube in the lineup
They would point downward and say that one. Yeah, it's still a part of pop culture, even though it's people who don't really watch it don't really respect it, even the way that if you don't, say, watch basketball, you don't disrespect it or kind of look down on its fans the way that wrestling fans seem to get a level of derision from.
Yeah, because there is this weird I mean, because it's clearly real, it's just scripted, I mean, that's the best way to describe wrestling. But for some reason, the fact that it's scripted makes all of the crazy things these people are doing, like, hey, I'll jump off a 30-foot cage and go through a table, why not? Like, that somehow devalues it as an athletic achievement, or I suppose a stunt achievement.
Yeah, well, it really doesn't get respect as a sport or as, theater,
Yeah.
which is basically what it is. It's a live soap opera that you can watch from every angle that's very violent.
Yeah.
But no, I find they don't get respect as actors, and they don't get a lot of respect as athletes because these athletic achievements, as you said, are for the most part planned.
Yeah.
And sometimes some improvisation is necessary.
Yeah, for sure.
But as I said, people who don't even watch it are very aware of it. And, the athletes who do very well in the WWE are legitimate pop culture icons, I would say. Mm-hmm. And the WWE is a big deal. $3.3 billion in assets last year. They do about 320 live shows a year, which is an insane number of live shows. Yeah.
There are 365 days in a year, in case anybody forgot.
Yeah. And so they have their own network now. They show their pay-per-views in movie theaters. They have live shows. They, as I said, they have all these house shows, so you can go to the stadiums and see them. Very big deal.
Yeah.
And so how do we get here? Well, it started in 1952 with Vince McMahon's grandfather and another gentleman, but we'll...
Sorry, you cut out.
I assume.
Sorry?
We'll be talking more about Vince McMahon, I assume.
Yes, because... I would think so. I want to talk about that broad-chested bastard for 40 minutes.
And that swagger he walks with at all times.
Love it so much.
Vince McMahon... his grandfather started this in 1952, and it was a much different world wrestling then. There was sort of a gentleman's agreement that the different promotions all over the country would kind of stay in their own territory. So there'd be Southern promotions, and they would kind of just tour around that area geographically and not really butt heads. Some alliances were formed between these different promotions to kind of say, you know, you can have that part of the country. I'll keep this part of the country, and we can both just have a good relationship where we don't interfere with each other.
Yeah.
Eventually, Vince McMahon got a powerful seat in the company and really changed that. When I say Vince McMahon, I mean the current owner of the WWE, or I guess he's a CEO.
Yes.
And what he did is basically ignore all those rules and started going into other territories and kind of coming up in direct competition with these other promotions. And the big thing he did was get wrestling on television. Mm-hmm. And wrestling was on TV for a bit in the 50s, but around the 80s is when McMahon started getting television deals. And this is when wrestling became much more of a pop culture sensation than a local touring thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of... He bought the WWE, I believe, from his father in 1982, and you can really tie the rise of wrestling basically with the rise of televised sports. ESPN starts in the 80s, and what David Stern does for the NBA in the 80s, right around the same time that Vince McMahon buys the WWE, and just sort of, there was the decade, the 80s was a decade where people learned how to package their materials in a way that they could make way more money from it and make themselves way more notable. And Vince McMahon is definitely falls in line with that.
Yeah, he's a good businessman. Like, it's to look at kind of what he started with and to where he is now. It's not like he was born poor. His dad was owning this company, but as I said, it was a much smaller deal, professional wrestling in general. And the way that he was able to do kind of what you said, package it for television and really get a good good grasp on how this new medium is going to need its product to be packaged. Mm-hmm. And things just went up from there. Yeah. His father was very against the idea of this kind of direct competition with other promotions, but he thought it was Vince thought it was the best thing for the company. So that's what he did. Yeah. And, you know, not just going into other people's territory and touring there and not just putting it on television, but very kind of cutthroat tactics were something Vince was known for at this time and
kind of still is.
The revenue he generated from the commercial ad sales, he would use to poach talent from other promotions. So it was very directly competitive in a way that was kind of unheard of at the time. And again, always looking to get bigger and better. He came up with this idea of WrestleMania, which was a big pay-per-view event that, you know, as I said, still goes on to this day, but was kind of unprecedented for professional wrestling at this time. Mm-hmm. To fill a stadium with, you know, 80,000 people, have a pay-per-view event. But it ended up being a big hit for him.
The first one was in Madison Square Garden, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And
which is an impressive starting point. Yeah.
Oh, it's exactly. That's what I mean. It's like, it's such a gamble to do something this big in such a big place. He really wanted to break into pop culture was his thing. He didn't want to be known, you know, just among those hardcore wrestling fans who would attend local shows. He wanted MTV to take notice. He wanted television. He wanted, you know, everything. So in an attempt to get kind of some pop culture crossover, he decided to get some celebrities for WrestleMania 1. And do you know who was there outside of the wrestlers?
No, I don't.
It's a sign of the time. Cyndi Lauper.
Great. Mr. T. I did know Cyndi Lauper, actually.
Mr. T. Yep. And Muhammad Ali.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. So when does Cyndi... Is Cyndi Lauper in the WWE Hall of Fame yet?
I don't know. The only Hall of Fame she's going to be in. And yeah, so WrestleMania was a big gamble, and it really paid off, though. And that's why... To this day, I think we have 12 pay-per-views a year with the WWE now.
Yeah.
Pretty much one a month.
Yep.
Of course, WrestleMania is still the big one, but the fact that we now have one every month, and this used to be one a year and was kinda quite a gamble at the time, shows you what a success it was.
Yeah.
So things were going very well for WrestleMania and Vince McMahon until 1992. When a steroid and sexual harassment scandal hit pretty hard, which is a nice combo. The most wrestling-sounding combo of crimes ever. Like, the WWE is a steroid scandal. It's a sexual harassment scandal. But, no, it actually did hit them pretty hard and cost them a lot in legal fees to fight them off. And most of all, it was just a big PR nightmare, and the public relations negative side of it sent a lot of people to the competition of the WWE, which was WCW, and which is World Championship Wrestling.
Yeah. Ted Turner ran it, right? Or did he buy it later?
I don't think he ran it at the time.
Oh, okay.
I might be wrong with that, though. Okay. Sorry, hardcore wrestling fan. This is what we were talking about.
It was the 90s, man.
Yeah, we didn't have a chance.
Yeah.
And so, again, this was another televised promotion that was competition with WWF. And in 1993,
WWE... Ted Turner did found the WCW.
Okay.
So we got the hardcore wrestling fans back.
Awesome. Yeah, they've tuned back in. Whatever that
is. You know how this works. You know how this definitely not an actual radio show works.
They heard it after they had tuned out and tuned back in.
They went on Twitter and found out that we corrected ourselves.
Right. So anyway, 1993, WWE starts Monday Night Raw, and it is a huge hit. Yeah. And they had been doing Saturday night events up until that point, and Monday Night was a big success for them. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean,
yeah, it's a yes, it makes sense. And to that point, I think like the biggest sporting event on Monday nights had been sort of those ESPN's Big East game of the week. In the prime of the Big East in the mid to late 80s, college basketball. And that I think, just kind of they saw that sports could play on a Monday, and they obviously couldn't do Sunday. I'm actually surprised they competed with Monday Night Football now that I'm thinking about it. But it's just, it makes sense. I'm happy that it's on Monday nights now because I can DVR it and slowly make my way through it over the course of the week because it's 3 fucking hours long every week now.
Right.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, Vince really wanted this to be kind of a pop culture thing and not just have those hardcore wrestling fans. And, you know, I don't think people are casually going to give their Saturday night up to watch wrestling.
No,
but,
absolutely. I mean, they don't do it for narrative TV, so they wouldn't do it for something new.
Exactly. Except the hardcores. Obviously, there's going to be some people, but Monday night, you don't ruin one of your weekend nights and you get to watch wrestling. It makes a lot of sense to me, and clearly it made a lot of sense to the public because the ratings were great. And then in 1995, TNT started Monday Nitro.
Yeah. So,
this was WCW going directly against Monday Night Raw in their time slot. So not only were they two people selling the same product, they were two people selling the same product in the same time slot. So this is as head-to-head as you can pretty much get for two competing wrestling promotions. Mm-hmm. And basically for the next, like, 2 years, it goes back and forth for ratings.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a crazy documentary called Monday Night Raw that explores this.
Monday Night Wars.
Oh, sorry, Monday Night Wars. That.
But Raw is war, so I understand.
Rise War. We know that. That would be a really biased documentary if they just called it Monday Night Raw about which show was better.
Nothing else was on TV on Monday nights. Nothing at all.
Yes, Monday Night Wars. Very, very cool documentary if you're into this kind of thing. But basically, some of those cutthroat tactics I mentioned of Vince McMahon's would kind of come back into play. And Eric Bischoff and Ted Turner on the other side had to kind of use some dirty tricks of their own.
Yeah.
And yes, they kind of go back and forth with the ratings.
Yeah, and the thing that was cool about those is that there was a good amount of talent in both both federations at the time. So if somebody was unhappy in one place, they could jump to another place and not really lose their position as a wrestler, where now you're kind of just, it's WWE or you're on the independent circuit, basically. Like if CM Punk had been around in the 90s, he would have had somewhere to go when he left WWE, as opposed to just doing whatever CM Punk is doing right now, you know? And
yeah.
I think that's kind of a really interesting aspect to have in wrestling that I would kind of be really interested in seeing it happen again, but it never will.
Yeah, no, I think it's so fascinating. And when we kind of compare it to other sports, as we kind of mentioned earlier, imagine the NHL and the NFL and the NBA had a real league that was competition for them.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who leaves those leagues is taking a major step down, not a small step down. But imagine, you know, LeBron James felt he was being disrespected by Commissioner Stern and just left the league after a year because he was so upset. Yeah. I mean, it would be so insane. It'd be such a mental story that we don't get that in other sports, but that's exactly what was happening at the time. People were getting upset with Vince McMahon and leaving, or getting pissed off at Eric Bischoff and quitting, and, you know, jumping back and forth. And eventually they had that invasion storyline, which is really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so unprecedented to have these two side by side leagues that were kind of just as big as each other for a little bit, at least on Monday night, or
yeah, exactly.
You know, and barely edging each other out every other week.
And it's not like competing leagues is not a story, or not a thing that ever existed in other sports. Like, I mean, there was the USFL for football, the ABA for the NBA, but they were never really on equal footing, and certainly not for the prolonged period of time that Nitro and Raw were in the 90s.
Yeah, it's a good few years of them really having it out back and forth. Somewhat famously, it was being called during a Monday Nitro. So what happened is a lot of the Raw events were pre-taped. So people would know the results, would know the winners, and that's something that you can do in wrestling. Since it is scripted, since it has results, and some of them tape and some of them don't, you can really know the results before they happen. And so in one of the dirty tricks that they would use against each other, the WCW would straight up read the results of Raw in the first minute of their show, which is...
I forgot about that.
Oh my God, that is one of my favorite things of the whole Monday Night Wars. Yeah. Is honestly, the show would come on at 8 o'clock, 8 to 8.01. They would just list off every card on the WWE Raw show that night and say who won, and then say, okay, now watch the rest of our show because you don't know what happens. You know everything about those other hours. Stay with us for these few hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not dirty in that they're doing anything illegal, I guess, but...
It's shitty.
It's so shitty. It's such a shitty thing to do to someone else. But it was their competition, and this was kind of what, like, this was not unheard of in this this war of theirs. They were going back and forth and doing things like this. Ted Turner started his wrestling event eventually at 7:59 instead of 8 o'clock, just so hardcore wrestling fans who were going to watch one or the other, oh, well, Nitro started first, I guess I'm stuck here for now.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. Ted Turner was pretty involved in this, and he had kind of a lot of money and his own TV network. So he could do things like this, like change time slots and move things up by 1 or 2 minutes, or something maybe as petty as reading the results of the event on the other channel.
Yeah. I mean, these are guys that just love engaging in pissing contests, Ted Turner and Vince McMahon, you know, so it's just sort of... it's something that they were more than happy to be a part of.
Yeah. I know, but it's just as wrestling. It's so wrestling. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Oh
like,
yeah,
it's,
for sure.
It this seems like something that someone would script. Like this competition between the two events, everything about it happening on the same night, the way that the CEOs were going after each other on television.
Yeah.
It's so indicative of this lifestyle that they've surrounded themselves with.
Well, and the thing is, like, if you look at wrestling storylines over the years, the best ones are ones that are very deeply rooted in real events that are going on at the time. And this was kind of a storyline and an actual thing at the exact same time, as opposed to something happening. And then, like, you know, Edge and Lita having sex when she's dating Matt Hardy, and then that turning into a storyline. This is those things happening concurrently, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of competitive dudes, like, doing anything they can very publicly. Yeah, it's just, it's amazing that that's what's happening, you know, in the ring, and that's what's also happening in the boardrooms is this very direct, rude public competition.
Yeah, Vince sees the ratings number, sees that Nitro beat Raw, puts his assistant through a table. That's, yeah. That's how it goes in the boardroom. I read insider accounts.
Yeah, kind of concurrent to the Monday Night Wars, we get the Attitude Era.
Yeah.
And this is Stone Cold being hired from the WCW and really making a very big name for himself in the WWF.
Mm-hmm.
What was your level of engagement with wrestling around this time?
Less than I wanted it to be, because my parents are pacifists, and it was just sort of like wrestling doesn't exist in my home. So it was when I could watch it at somebody else's house, basically.
Okay.
And it was like harder to catch replays. So if I wasn't hanging out with my buddy, and also I had one friend that liked wrestling. So if I wasn't hanging out with my buddy Kevin on Monday nights, then I missed it. You know, Monday or Friday, because SmackDown mattered back then too.
Right.
But yeah, no, it was just when I watched it, I was definitely into it. But I can't say I watched too much of it.
Okay. And now,
I love reading about it.
Yeah. It's everything's different when you're that age. Like, it's hard to kind of put what you are interested, or maybe your age group is interested in the whole pop culture landscape.
Yeah.
But this seems like the biggest wrestling got, like the deepest it got into pop culture.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because I mean, if you just look at Stone Cold, he's just such a charismatic person. And just him walking to the ring and yelling at nobody, like I could watch that for 3 hours. And he just has this type of charisma that it's hard to compare to. And then The Rock has even more charisma, you know, and it's just like it's the two of them together in wrestling at the same time. And add in Degeneration X, which was the suck it thing, was just really fun to do. And it's kind of like the Macarena didn't, like, the song didn't matter as much as the dance being fun for idiots to do, you know. It's just the crotch chop was so much fun that DX just became a thing, you know.
And it's so vulgar. But people are just doing it to their teachers all the time.
And also, like, I still do suck it crotch chops as jokes to people, and like it lands every time.
I know. What hand gesture from like mid-90s wrestling can you do, or like mid-90s at all?
Yeah. No, exactly.
I mean, lands.
Maybe the that episode of Friends where they had some like different version of the middle finger, but I suppose I don't even remember what it is.
Where you hit your wrist together.
Yeah, is that it? Yes, that is it. Yeah, yeah, I think that would hit with a specific set of people.
Yeah, and I guess the L on your forehead.
Was that a 90s thing? I feel that was a lot.
That's like early 2000s. That's like Mystery Men era.
Okay, I thought it was, I don't know. Anyway, continue.
Well, it is said in the song All Star by Smash Mouth, so it can't be after that.
Yeah, because Smash Mouth started everything.
The band of public record.
On the seventh day, God created Smash Mouth.
The surf punk band of public record.
Anyway, were you watching a lot of wrestling during the late 90s?
Maybe not. I don't know. A little bit. because I played a lot of wrestling video games is what I'm...
Yeah, oh, I played a ton of wrestling video games.
That's what I've been thinking about kind of the most. I think that's what I was the most engaged in, because I definitely did watch it, and I definitely had one friend who kept up with it pretty closely and was a gigantic D-Generation X fan. But yeah, I think I played more wrestling video games than I watched, but I don't know. It was always present, and yeah, that's what I mean. I don't know if that was just being a teenage boy or if that was the Attitude Era really becoming part of the public consciousness.
Well, I think it was a bit of both, because if you kind of look at the late 90s, the Attitude Era just kind of beats the gun on anti-heroes. And the sort of anti-hero phenomenon in, you know, big pop culture starts with The Sopranos, which starts in 1999. And so they were really tapping into something that was a part of the culture, and or about to be a part of the culture. And I think that's a big part of why the Attitude Era was as successful as it was. It sort of mixed the things that we liked about antiheroes like Tony Soprano and mixed them with the other things that were about to become big cultural things, like Jackass, like stunts, or just fucking with people, pranking them. And I think that's kind of what the Attitude Era was, and that's what allowed it to be bigger than, I think, like we've said, any other wrestling storyline or wrestling era. And yeah, and I think it was kind of the point where wrestling was very, as opposed to reflecting what happens in the culture after it's already happened, it was kind of ahead of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, as I said, I think it was bigger than it was before and has been since. And I think one of the ways I would probably be able to tell that is that people knew at least that Stone Cold and Vince McMahon's were, you know, like head to head in some way, were adversaries.
Yeah.
And I think even just to know one storyline, even though that was the central storyline of the Attitude Era and, you know, took like stretched out over years and years. Mm-hmm. I don't know another time where you could be like, hey, what's basically going on in wrestling to the average person, and they could say something, you know, they'd say like, oh, John Cena's beating people, or, you know, like The Rock is lifting his eyebrow, or that, you know.
The CM Punk thing in 2011, I think it was, crossed over a little bit, but nothing in comparison to what you're talking about.
Exactly. I remember thinking, wow, people, like, this is getting to more people than I thought, and then kind of putting that in context with Stone Cold versus Mr. McMahon. And yeah, as you said, it doesn't compare. And that's part of that is just the digital age and the internet. No one's going to be involved in anything the way that we used to get. Like the average person got involved with things because there was only so many outlets of entertainment.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 97, that's a lot, and let alone 2011 or 2014.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we talked about the Attitude Era a bit, but the McMahon Austin feud, but I think what really starts that is the, or at least the potential for Mr. McMahon to be a villain, is the Montreal Screwjob.
Yeah, let's talk. Give everyone the entire history of the Montreal Screwjob. Go.
Okay, so Bret Hart is champion. Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels do not get along backstage. Bret Hart is going to leave WWE. He wants to do so on give up his belt. He has the title at the time. He wants to give up his belt on Monday Night Raw. The day after, it was SummerSlam, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and which is their summer WrestleMania, basically. It's one of the big four. So he's going to do that on a speech on Raw after beating Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam. And
yeah, he just to clarify, he doesn't want to give up his title. He wants to defend it and then vacate the title.
Exactly.
The WWE. Like, yeah. He doesn't want to lose it. He wants to defend it one more time against Shawn Michaels, and then kind of, you know, leave on top.
Yeah.
And Shawn Michaels and Vince McMahon are a lot more buddy-buddy at this point than McMahon and Hart are.
Yeah, for sure. And what ends up happening at SummerSlam is that, and this is also in Canada, Bret Hart is a Canadian. It's in Montreal, which you may have guessed from the name of the event.
We didn't just bore the name of a sex act, but named after French Canadians, this does take place in Montreal.
And yeah, so what happens is Shawn Michaels at one point puts Bret Hart in Hart's own submission maneuver, and the ref basically says that Bret Hart submitted, and Bret Hart loses, and Shawn Michaels wins the belt. And Bret Hart did not know this was going to happen.
No.
So,
clearly.
Yeah, that's the Montreal Screwjob, and a very big, particularly to one of your flagship stars, and he was a huge part of wrestling in the 90s, to do that to them was just kind of, was a bad thing. And yeah, wrestlers in his... backstage did not react kindly to it, because Bret Hart was really well-liked, too.
Yeah, as, you know, from my understanding, he was very well-liked by fans and other wrestlers. Like, I think he was just respected as someone who was nice to people and worked hard, because he's Canadian and that's what happened. But no, as you said, though, other wrestlers didn't like it because, one, they liked the guy who was kind of the victim of this. And second of all, they, you know, it's like if your boss screws over your coworker, your job security doesn't feel that good anymore.
Yeah, for sure.
You don't like your boss that much anymore, and that easily could have been you. And one of the things that's so fascinating about the WWE is that they have so much control of these people's legacies. Like, Ric Flair can come back in his 50s and 60s and still win belts because they decide he's going to win belts. Like,
yeah.
You don't get that in other sports. You can't just say, I mean, everyone says that other major sports try what they can to prop up the teams or the athletes they like. And,
yeah.
You know, but you've heard about, like, the Lakers getting certain calls because the NBA wants the Lakers to do well because they bring in a lot of revenue for the league. But this is just...
Which happens.
Well, yes, okay. Exactly. And it's kind of, everyone knows that. But yeah. It's the level of control in the WWE, because it is scripted, is just unprecedented. You know, things happen and need to be improvised. But these major storylines and things like who the winner is can be planned 100%.
Exactly.
When something like the Montreal Screwjob happens, it's, I guess, really unnerving, because... For these athletes, you know, they're not just their livelihood, which of course is very important, but their legacy, their public perception is so much in the hands of Vince McMahon and the writers. And so something like this, where one thing is promised to someone who, you know, paid his dues, was a nice guy who worked hard, for him to get screwed like this is unprecedented and very, very terrible for other wrestlers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is what made, you know, I mean... even just to think of how Vince McMahon was portrayed to the diehards at that point, or how he looked to the diehards at that point. It was like, well, he was a villain anyway, so he might as well be a villain on screen and capitalize on it. And with Stone Cold was the best at being like the anti-authority hero. And
yeah.
So I think they just kind of recognized what they had and were like, okay, let's run with this. Let's make Alex and James really happy for like 4 years every time they watch Raw.
Yeah. In a few years, yeah. Yeah, it's just that level of real-world results and making him this fake world, but... I don't know. It's this weird space that wrestling and wrestling fans occupy, where they look at it from, like, they look at everything at the same time. And you think knowing the real side of it would completely negate and render moot everything inside the fictitious WWE universe.
Yeah.
And this is such a great example of something that smart fans know everything that happened here, and they hate Vince McMahon like so much for it. And all that hate gets put on Mr. McMahon. And it's just such a good example of how wrestling kind of occupies these two spaces at once, and how things in the real world work their way into these, you know, fictitious narrative storylines. As you said, when
they really started to up that, too.
Yeah. And another thing about the Attitude Era is that it gets more adult-oriented.
Yeah.
Stone Cold in the 80s wouldn't have been Stone Cold the way he was in the late 90s.
No, and even if you watched him on WrestleMania on Sunday, the camera when he was getting into the ring and he's, you know, going up the turnbuckles and he's clearly going to do the middle finger thing that he did every time he went into the ring. The cameras, every time he got on a turnbuckle, cameras zoomed in and cut him off right at the hands just because you can't show that anymore.
They framed him just above his wrist was out of frame.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's two things happening when I say it's getting more adult oriented. It's things like it's doing that with things like swearing and beer drinking, like Stone Cold drinking two beers in the ring / 2% of two beers.
Yeah. And then taking a couple for the road when he actually ends up walking out. Yeah. I love that he still did that on WrestleMania too. It made me so happy.
I love to think that he sees that as a real perk of his job. Like, he makes so much money. Well, not tons of money, but he makes a pretty good chunk of change, I would imagine, from the WWE when he shows up.
Yeah.
And he's still like, awesome, four more Budweiser than I get. Amazing. So it's getting adult oriented in things like swearing and beer drinking, and they kind of up the sexuality a little bit at that point, I believe, as well. But also, as we said about McMahon, like, knowing that there are smart fans who, and, you know, we assume some of these smarter fans are the older fans, you know, high teens or full on adults, let's say. He's starting to play to this thing that people know it's scripted. Some people are smarter than they're being written to now. So let's do things like engage these real life storylines and news headlines and work that into the product. And the people who know about the whole business really get a deeper level of engagement now that they know kind of Vince McMahon is an asshole in person too.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, all those storylines about, you know, affairs or drug use or things not going well backstage, you can start plugging that into the storyline. And that's not you know, mature in a rated R sense, but it's just more mature, and people who have a better understanding of the product now can really get engaged with it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we talked about part of the reason why, I mean, we talked about the general charisma of Stone Cold and The Rock, but it was just like talent wise, even beyond that, was pretty good. So they were able to pull off a lot more. Like, the New Age Outlaws will always make me smile, specifically the Road Dogg, Jesse James. Billy Gunn, nobody cares about him at all. He's the Garfunkel of the two. And Mr. McMahon was really good as well. Like, if he wasn't a good charismatic performer, and same with Shane and Stephanie, the whole storyline would have fallen flat. And that Mr. McMahon is such a good performer too. And a middle-aged man that was okay with having the shit kicked out of him on TV too, you know, like all of these things really combining in such a weird way helped make the Attitude Era really bizarre and interesting. And even with the in-ring action, you talked about how things were getting a bit more mature, but the hardcore wrestling influence really rubbed off at this time too. We've got Mankind in his prime, and Mick Foley is a notorious lunatic for all of the things he's done in the ring. The Hardy Boys and Edge and Christian and the Dudleys were like all of those three tag teams were all willing to do basically whatever, and put their bodies on the line. And we got some really crazy ladder matches and table matches and stuff with them at the time, and a lot of no holds barred with Triple H and The Undertaker as well. Like, people were just doing crazy shit, and I think that's part of the WWE really being on top of the way culture was moving, because that is the same time as Jackass is on TV and becomes a big influential part of culture, you know. And and I think that's a key part of the Attitude Era that we've kind of haven't talked about, is the actual in-ring action got more intense.
Those people like the Dudleys and the Hardy Boys and stuff, this is very high risk moves is what they're known for, like lots of high flying stuff. So much of wrestling is fake, but there's only so much you can fake about jumping off a ladder through a table. Like, you can pad the ground, you can make sure that the guy is ready to be landed on in a certain way, but it's not CGI. Like, this is happening. This is very physical and immediate and real for the people doing it. And, you know, for the fans who are right there and the fans watching at home know that that's happening.
Yeah.
This is someone falling through a steel cage, like onto the ring. It's real. Even if it's somewhat planned, or as planned as it can get with in the case of those the steel cages like that. It's real.
Yeah. And that's kind of what put a stop to the Attitude Era, is that like Vince McMahon and the other people backstage started getting concerned that somebody was just going to die in the ring, you know? And it's just kind of, cause you don't see matches like that anymore. And I'm kind of happy we don't. I don't know if I could watch wrestling as an adult if those things were still going on. I feel like, because I get kind of worried that the people are going to die in the ring now as is. And I kind of have that same feeling every time I watch football too. But like, they just couldn't keep it up. Because like Jeff Hardy would have died in the ring if nobody told him, no, you can't do that. You know?
Yeah, and he still does very risky stuff, but it's just not the same.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jeff Hardy isn't in the WWE anymore because he's too willing to put himself at risk.
Yeah, and with the, as you said, with kind of the extreme wrestling, ECW is around at this point, and a lot of the hardcore wrestling fans are going to that because it's just, you know, it's just more extreme. That's, you'll see a lot of the stuff with the, a lot of like the bleeding and the barbed wire and like stapling and broken light bulbs and stuff. And that stuff was kind of coming into the WWF, I guess, at this point a little bit. And yeah, I think they kind of said, like, how far can we go with this? Like, yeah. I remember thinking, how are they going to get out of it? Like, is it just going to get crazier and crazier, or are they going to have to find a new angle?
Yeah, and, well, sorry.
And things, no, like things with Stone Cold and McMahon, like it was such a good storyline, but it wasn't because it was the most high risk, gory stuff happening. Like when we think about that feud, you know, it was huge, but I can think of some of Stone Cold getting pretty bloodied up, but it really wasn't like, oh, this is the most hardcore thing happening in wrestling. This is the biggest thing happening in wrestling then. It really wasn't like that. It was, let's get some really charismatic people. Let's write some good stories for them. And let's just get everyone really, really amped up about some good performers, and we don't have to, you know, slice each other with razor blades to get a good product in the ring.
Yeah, for sure. And another part of kind of what ended the Attitude Era was Stone Cold basically, he left the WWE. He ended up having a lot of injury problems anyway. I don't know how much longer he could have wrestled anyway. But and then The Rock left the WWE as well. And that kind of really, I think that was around the same time that they both left, and that kind of ended the Attitude Era in combination with the WWE being like, okay, we got to tone some of this stuff down, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of leads us to
2001.
Sorry.
I was going to say 2001, McMahon manages to buy WCW and ECW.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the end of the official end of the Monday Night Wars, really.
Yeah.
Because there's no WCW anymore. And as I said, ECW wasn't huge, but they had some good performers. And
WWE ended up buying that, too.
Yeah, at the same time, or very, very close to each other. They bought WCW and ECW. And so that was a pretty big shift. Yeah. And one of the big big turning points at the end, for the end of the Monday Night Wars, at least, was Nitro announcer saying something, I'm paraphrasing, but Mankind is wrestling tonight in the WWE, and he used to wrestle for us, but no point in flipping over because here's the result. Basically, he's going to win. So then the announcers kind of laugh to themselves and say, yeah, that's going to put some butts in seats over at the WWE. And that's seen as a very, very big blunder for them, because ratings wise, it appears that everyone changed the channel to see Mankind win that title. And that's seen as kind of one of the last big missteps for the WCW before they get bought out.
Yeah, for sure.
And so reality era, the end of the Attitude Era brings about the reality era, I guess. I think there's a little bit of nothingness in between.
Oh, there's a lot of nothingness in between. And I think that's kind of what I don't know. Anytime you kind of get this explosion of incredible talent and creativity, there's going to be a down period after some of your key cogs leave, you know? And once Edge goes from a B level guy to an A guy, just because he has to, you're going to lose a bit of you know, a bit of the luster that you had previously. Like, I always think about the early 2000s in basketball, like after Michael Jordan left and every NBA team had one gunner that was just shooting 30 shots a game and they were getting their points, but it was like a bad, horrible kind of basketball until the 2003 draft class came in with LeBron, Bosh, Wade, all those guys. And, yeah, you just kind of get a down period and, WWE had a pretty long one after that, and I think we can just call it the John Cena era, because he after a couple of years after the Attitude Era, he becomes the big name of the WWE, and there's kind of nobody to challenge him. I talked about Edge a little bit. I love Edge. You love Edge. Everybody loves Edge because he's an amazing, charismatic performer. But he wasn't the type of person that could get people to tune in, like Stone Cold or The Rock could. And he was, you know, people like him and Alberto Del Rio and Randy Orton were kind of the people that Cena had to go against for a while. And those were like the A-level matches, you know. And I mean, we had pieces of time where The Miz was Cena's biggest contender, and like, I think Orton's a really good wrestler, like in ring I think he's incredible, but he's not great on the mic, you know, and
still hasn't found his personality. Like,
yeah,
he's a psycho. Yeah. Okay.
it's pretty weak. And Alberto Del Rio, I love his, he's a good in ring fighter too. He's not great on the mic, even though I love him yelling as he walks to the ring, because I love it anytime somebody does that. But, yeah, there was this kind of dry spell, and that really hurts the smart fans' opinions of John Cena in general, just because he got the shit marketed out of him only because he was the only option, really. And that kind of really sums up that period of time for wrestling, probably about 6 years, maybe even longer, where it was kind of a dead zone, you know.
Yeah, it's so weird to think about that, because, like, basically a lot of those people you just described, you feel are like B-level, but there's just not a lot of A-levels around, so they just got the push, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like, in my mind, Edge deserves to be, like, fighting for the belt. I don't think WWE ever wanted him to really fight for WWE champion. You know, he seems like the best of the Intercontinental class, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so hard to know who's going to be a great wrestler, and I just mean not just in ring, but a great performer for your brand. Mm-hmm. It's so subjective, and it's just so difficult to quantify, like, what made Stone Cold so good, you know. Why was he so entertaining? And it's like, oh, well, he was charismatic and kind of had a look and a feel to him. And it's like, yeah, but it's all so intangible and so hard to put your finger on.
And he was good in the ring. I mean, there's a certain level you get to where you kind of have to be good in the ring to justify your position. But
yeah,
you know, in Stone Cold, everybody loves the stunner. That was always helpful. But yeah, he was a good performer in ring. Like, his charisma didn't stop when the microphone got taken away.
Yeah, but then again, there's people who are great, you know, in-ring technical wrestlers and do nothing on the mic.
Exactly, like Del Rio and Orton, you know?
Yeah, and I was watching someone, wrestling with someone recently, and again, I've been watching that much wrestling lately, and I saw Big E. Do you know who this is? Big E Langston?
Yeah, of course. He's just Big E now. They dropped the Langston.
Yeah, I know. I didn't know if you had been aware of the name change, so I just say Langston. But I was watching it with someone who kind of, I don't know, a bit like me, but watches less wrestling, like was very fascinated by it, watched it as a kid, was kind of interested in it as a sports entertainment product, but wasn't fully engaged with what was going on. And I was just pointing out, I was like, oh, I don't really know this guy, but he must be bad on the mic. And they said, well, how do you know that? I'm like, well, he's a very good wrestler. Like, Big E is massive. Like, yeah, he's got the body of a wrestler. Like,
he is a steroid scandal.
Yeah, he is the steroid scandal. But he was a power lifter and still holds some records in Florida for, like, weightlifting and stuff like that. So he's got the body for it. But I was just like, look, they never let him talk. He's out there with a manager. Wrestlers don't really need managers.
Yeah.
You know, so some people just have everything it takes physically, but just can't get on the mic, don't have that charisma, don't have that ability to speak and or improvise and engage with people. And that's what it takes to be kind of an A-plus star, the way The Rock, Stone Cold, Hogan, some of these people who are, you know, legends.
Yeah. And I mean, you and I talked a bit about it on Sunday after we watched WrestleMania together. Kofi Kingston is very much the same way.
So fucking talented.
Yeah, he's incredible. And it's just, he just couldn't ever get a push because I assume he's bad on the mic. I can't think of any time that I've ever seen him on the mic, you know,
which
means he can't be good at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Particularly since we're like right now, WWE's putting everybody on the mic, you know, which I think is very helpful. But
You think that's good?
I'm more into the pomp than the circumstance when I'm watching wrestling, you know, like it's just, I like the promos and stuff. I like the intros more than I like the matches a lot of times, you know, like I'm very into just the WWE, I think, more than I am wrestling. Yeah.
But what about good? Like I'm always amazed by how the managers really do find their way in. Like the fact that there's multiple,
you mean like Paul Heyman?
Yeah. Like someone like Paul Heyman can have a career for a long time just kind of shepherding around guys who aren't great on the microphone.
Yeah.
But
he's got Cesaro now, which makes me very excited.
But people hate him, like, which in the WWE is a great thing. Like, he really gets fans going. Like, he really, really gets people engaged, obviously in a negative sense. But any engagement in wrestling is good engagement from the WWE's perspective.
Yeah, there's a different level to the for somebody like Paul Heyman. Smart wrestling fans don't hate him, and you kind of look at him on Raw this week, which was in the day after WrestleMania in New Orleans, where he was announced to be Cesaro's new manager, and the crowd lost their minds. We're so pro Heyman, and it was really really fun to watch, and because he's incredible, he's great on the mic, and he's the ideal person for somebody that that isn't great on the mic that you kind of want to be around. And that's why I'm really happy that Cesaro's got him in his corner now, because Cesaro is a very, very, very talented wrestler. And I think he can eventually be good on the mic, but he's just not right now.
Yeah, he's a fantastic wrestler. But yeah, Paul Heyman, you just want to punch him in the face before he opens his mouth.
Well, he looks like the kind of guy that you want to punch in the face.
Exactly. Like, he looks just like the slimiest, greasiest guy.
Yeah, like even his skin isn't great, you know, it just doesn't help, you know, but it also totally helps, you know. And yeah, it's just kind of these managers are people that are charismatic in the same way that good wrestlers are. They just can't, they're just not the athletes that they are. And I think it's a great element of wrestling that I love. Like even just having Stephanie McMahon out ringside when Triple H is fighting, I love that too because she's a really great performer. I think it adds a nice, really nice element.
Yeah,
particularly her Breakfast Club reference. I think she was just trying to reference things that were 30 years old.
Yeah. It's amazing how more consequential can be than a referee.
Yeah.
The fact that the referees are almost entirely useless.
Yeah. Well, useless in the actual storyline of WWE, but very important in the way the match moves between players, you know.
Yeah.
Like just keeping
it going.
Talk
about that a bit.
Yeah, cuz I mean just because wrestling, there are so many shows, you know, even the main eventer from main eventers from WrestleMania are wrestling the next night. You know, like this is like Russell Wilson winning the Super Bowl and then having to practice the next day.
Yeah, or someone who takes more of a pounding than Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, so,
did
like
I
a
say
tackle
Westbrook?
Or something.
I meant Wilson. Anyway, yeah, and it's just there's no time to really script out whole matches. That just doesn't happen. With WrestleMania, you'll clearly get more. WrestleMania and the pay-per-views, you'll get more clearly scripted spots. But the average match is very, very highly improvised. And
You'll get maybe a result in a few set pieces, especially leading up to that result. But
yeah, exactly.
Lots of improvisation throughout.
Yeah. And if you watch wrestling closely, you can always see the wrestlers. You can't always hear them depending on where the camera is. But you can always see wrestlers talking to each other, and you assume because they're fighting each other, they're taunting, but they're just sort of like calling out the next move, like saying spine buster or something, you know, and then you throw Triple H saying spine buster and then throwing Daniel Bryan into the ropes and have him come back for a spine buster. And there's a lot of rest holds, like to get a bit of a breather. This is generally the time when WWE will throw in replays of the big move that led to this rest hold.
Like you'll get a pin that's definitely not going to work, but because a well-run machine, they say, okay, do a submission move that's not ever going to work ever, and that will give us 10 seconds to show that huge splash you did. And you know, there's no communication between the guy in the control room and the wrestlers, but they've done this so many times, and they know how it's done.
And the referee very frequently has an earpiece, and the referee communicates with the wrestlers and helps keep things going, checking to make sure that if there are injuries that people know about them as soon as possible, like the people in the ring, because the match will always go on. It's just it'll get altered if somebody breaks their leg in the ring, you know. Yeah. And the referees are very, very important. But one of my favorite parts of wrestling is thinking about the logic of the referee being there. They're just there for the three count, you know?
Yeah.
Like I think you said to me at one point during wrestling, or during WrestleMania, said, all right, guys, I'm going to explain some rules to you that nobody's going to follow and nobody's going to care. And I'm not going to do anything about it.
Yeah. Won't be enforced.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just going back to the wrestlers speaking to each other and saying moves. There's some good videos you can find on YouTube, but often you'll see it, as you said, kind of in the submission holds or when they're kind of like shoulder to shoulder right before they throw them into the ropes or in a turnbuckle or something. Mm-hmm. You can often see their mouths moving there, and it's quite clear it's not a taunt. Like it's like a whisper right into their ear and stuff like that. It's not very aggressive. But as you said, yeah, the refs will have an earpiece, so there is some communication, because it would be dangerous for the wrestlers to have an earpiece. Obviously, it'd be very helpful, but they're taking too many blows to the head for that to be a thing. So,
And it would really remove an element of illusion. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It would, because it kind of makes sense that a ref would have an earpiece if you were a real ref that actually did anything ever. But yeah, so the writers and Vince and people in the control room can talk to the refs, look like they are threatening or admonishing someone for breaking a rule, and it'll often be kind of advice for what the next move is going to be.
Yeah, for sure. I have a question for you, because I think the time when you and I were both the most into wrestling, because there was a time when we lived together with our other roommate when we were watching wrestling every Monday. And it was like appointment television for us. This was in 2006. This is very much the Cena and Edge days. Why did we watch wrestling? Like, as a general question, like, why are we interested in wrestling? Because I think the fact that we watched the most then, and we've lived together since then and didn't watch wrestling, we lived together during the CM Punk thing in 2011, but we didn't watch it every week. Why? So it means wrestling at its core is interesting, but why? You know?
Yeah. Why at that time?
Oh, and just no. Why in general? Like, why do you watch wrestling? Because there is something, a core value in wrestling that you enjoy, you know? And I think just because we watched in those down years, I think that proves that.
Yeah. Definitely some of the things we've said already, just because, and a huge part of it for me is just how unique it is. Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting product that it's this mix of, you know, it is a soap opera. It's a stunt show. It's kind of a sport because, I mean,
it's definitely a sport.
I still can't say that, though.
Okay, well then it's all right. Fine.
Because legally,
it's an athletic achievement.
Okay, absolutely, I'll give you that. Yeah. But I think legally you can't call it a sport, okay. So I'm not going to be able to use that word. Sports entertainment is the best way to, way to define it. Yeah, because it's so unique. I think especially at that time we were learning and appreciating a lot about just postmodernism in general, and it's engages that in such a weird way where it's like the secret's out, everyone knows it's a lie, but we're just going to live with it. Mm-hmm. Because the product is just so fascinating, and I'm just so fascinated by the way that things happen in real life and then they trickle down into the show and they kind of go through these filters where, you know, let's take something real, some real feelings, a real storyline, and kind of break it up into little pieces and see how it can fix our little narrative. It's fascinating that there's such a history for so long. And yeah, just Vince McMahon gets to be the commissioner or the referee that everyone always claims the other commissioners are. Like, I understand.
He's Bud Selig stopping the All-Star game, but he's doing it every week.
Exactly. It's, I understand that these commissioners definitely have real power. I mean, yeah, Bud Selig did stop that. And I believe Stern does pressure certain officials certain ways.
He's not the commissioner anymore now. It's Adam Silver. But
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, but they do kind of wield some power and, you know, pressure people, or there's kind of an implicit culture where certain things go certain ways. But Vince just gets to do it. Vince gets to do whatever he wants. And the way that people engage with other sports where they will hate a commissioner or hate a superstar or hate a certain player, the NBA just gets to run with that. Like, it is the most, it's in some ways, it's the essence of the way people watch real sports just gets blown up and magnified, and you get to have so much fun with it in the WWE. And yeah, the way people would want to punch Bud Selig in the face, like, you just want to kill Vince McMahon sometimes. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's, he's so mean, he's so awful. And but yeah, the athletic stuff is so impressive. Like, I mean, I watched Jackass and thought it was funny and cool, but the stuff that they're doing in this is, like, the way that they have to improvise stuff, the way that they're performing, and the way that they are performing, you know, theatrically and athletically simultaneously, yeah, the way that they have to improv. Like, I think everything is just, every show is such an achievement, even when there are parts of it that I'm just bored by or not interested in.
Which is basically every show. every show has something.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, WrestleMania, definitely I was interested the whole time, but for a Monday Night Raw to do that, like, that's pretty unheard of.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's so unique, and it's the way that you're watching and you have to watch how the crowd likes these people to see how the WWE is going to play them and then what position that's going to put them in and how the fans are going to like that. And I think in a way, it's just the most democratic sport. It's definitely the sport where the fans' reactions have the most to do with the product by leaps and bounds. Like, nothing even comes close to it. You know, there's definitely the sixth man or the 12th man or whatever, depending on which sport you're watching. But the level of control that the fan reaction has on the product, such a kind of directly honed product right for the fans, even if it's doing things the fans will hate, it's the kind of hate you want in a sport, yeah, entertainment product like this.
Yeah,
so yeah, definitely the level of fan interaction, I think, is awesome.
Yeah, and, well, like any given wrestling match, I'm watching the crowd 40% of the time.
Yeah,
I find that so fascinating.
If anyone's never been to a live wrestling event or even seen a pay-per-view of it in theaters with a group of people, it's incredible. Like, it's that level of fan engagement I was talking about. It's unprecedented. Like, people were starting their own chants, people are joining in with the chants, people are starting their own, people are like, it's like an old vaudeville show at times. People are yelling stuff at the screen, and like, oh, sometimes the crowd would react, and like the rest of the theater would laugh or boo. Like, it's not like any viewing experience I've ever had. So it's like, just for the uniqueness, even if you don't care about wrestling, just to see how people engage with this product and how much it means to them and how they really feel that they are participating in the product, and in a way they are,
yeah,
I think is so fascinating to me, and I never get over that.
Yeah, and the thing that is really interesting is that it's kind of like every game coming down to a last second shot, you know? Like, it's a sport,
yeah,
where they're like, you know, there are no blowouts, you know? And it's sort of, that's how they're able to get such a good audience reaction, because crowds at good basketball games or good football games are always good, but the game isn't always good because it can't always be good, because it's not scripted. And
yeah,
that's sort of what I find in wrestling a lot, is that It engages me the way sports do, in that like a really, really big moment in sports will get me very excited. Like the game six of the NBA finals, like I had to leave the house and go grocery shopping after it was over. I could not go to sleep. And that's what I love about sports. But wrestling, like, you're guaranteed to get some level of that. And they're so good at really pushing the envelope of how close they will get to the end and then taking you away from it with like near falls. Like the main event of WrestleMania, Orton had a pin, Batista had a pin right before Daniel Bryan got his, and they were like the best two counts I've ever seen. Like both of them were amazing, and just so close to three counts before the wrestler kicked out, and it like you just kind of are able to get into it, even though you know it's scripted. It's just like it brings in all of these cues you know from other athletic competition. Like you know that this is close to the end of the match, and you're just like, oh, this might be it. Oh, it's not it. That's amazing. You know, like we get another 30 seconds. We get another flying knee from Daniel Bryan, you know, and it's awesome. And I love it. You know?
Yeah. And I think being engaged in other sports helps. Like, as you said, you kind of get all these kind of touchstones from other sports and the excitement and the kind of what's going to happen next. And then that kind of slips right back into your mind when you're watching WWE sometimes. And you know, if you ever ask me while I'm watching if it's scripted, I'd obviously say yes. But like, there are moments where you kind of lose it, and you're just watching it as two people competing instead of two people acting out someone else's play.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, even the if we're calling it somebody else's play, like that is highly improvised on the fly. Like plot lines will change in the middle of shows, you know. Which I find interesting. Like the more you know about wrestling, the more interesting it is. Like I think there's a level you could get to where you kind of know too much, but I'm not there, and I'm happy about that. But yeah, there's so much on the internet that you can learn about any given Raw, any given like weekly show of Raw. That's fascinating, and yeah, it's really interesting to know how these things work, and knowing that they change things so on the fly. Specifically, the Randy Orton Batista initial WrestleMania main event, how they ended up putting Daniel Bryan in it, I think. Was very interesting, which I really do not think was the plan.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going to talk about fan participation and fan reaction dictating what they do, Daniel Bryan, like that's
yeah,
all
exactly.
There is.
And I mean, it's kind of amazing, like how, like this is something that I found so interesting about wrestling recently, and why I've watched so much of it, and why I think I will probably watch next week's Raw, even though this podcast will be done. I kind of think the WWE is in a really great place right now, talent-wise. And I think WrestleMania was really meant to show you that. I mean, you had the Shield going crazy on the New Age Outlaws and Kane in a very, very impressive way. And I already liked the Shield. It was like two flippy guys, which is my favorite kind of wrestler. I believe that's the technical term, is flippy guy. Yeah. Roman Reigns, who's a big strong guy but is also athletic. Like I generally hate the big strong guys unless they're athletic. I find them super boring, and I love Roman Reigns. I think he's great. And there's the Shield. The Wyatts are really interesting, specifically Bray, because Bray's really good in the ring too. All of his moves are good. Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, I still think is a really good wrestler, even though he's not good on the ring. Like if you watch the main event from WrestleMania, he's really carrying it at the points when Daniel Bryan's out of the match. And I mean, if CM Punk comes back, then that's, if he ever comes back, that's so, so great. And that's just so much good talent. And then you add in Daniel Bryan, which is just such an interesting, interesting thing, because a big part of his appeal is how generic he is. He's a very, very talented in the ring, but he's very small. Like we talked about this a bit during his first match at WrestleMania with Triple H. Like just standing next to Triple H, the difference is so huge. Yeah. And like Triple H is a big guy, but Daniel Bryan is like, he's thicker than me, but he's shorter than me, you know?
I think he's like a 5'10" white guy with no gimmick.
Like, yeah, that's exactly it. And his moves are pretty generic. Like he does everything well, and he always surprises me with how athletic he is. But he does nothing poorly. But he also doesn't have, like, he finished his match with Triple H by kneeing him in the face. Like that was his thing. And he's this really he's such a man of the people. Like, his face is so obscured by hair right now, you know, like it's, it's maybe 20% face when he's doing a promo, you know? And I think that's so interesting. And part of it is that he's a real contrast to John Cena, who I really like and think gets shit on unfairly because of the era he was a part of, or the face of. And just Daniel Bryan next to John Cena, they just look totally different. John Cena couldn't look less like the crowd, and Daniel Bryan, it would be hard for him to look more like the crowd, you know?
Yeah.
And and his chant is so simple, and and like, who doesn't believe in the idea of yes, you know? Like,
it's the most positive thing that so, could be.
Yeah, Daniel Bryan's so interesting. And yeah. I think the fact that he ended up winning the belt by submission is such a wonderful thing. Like, he, the fans and Daniel Bryan eventually beat the Authority into submission. I love that so much.
Yeah, you know? It's kind of perfect.
Because I almost never want a match to end with a submission move. And yeah, that was the perfect time to do that.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Bray Wyatt, and it's just a short thing about that, and then I have another question for you. But Bray Wyatt reminds me of, like, if you go back and watch wrestling throughout the time periods, there's all these little, like, things that were happening in pop culture that just kind of bleed into wrestling. Like, they'll do, like, a small reference to something, or little, like, subcultures that were around at the time. Like, Bray Wyatt reminds me of, like, Duck Dynasty, True Detective, like, yeah. Southern, just generic, like, that. You know, it's not a specific reference to anything like that, but it's just things that were kind of in the, like, pop culture arena at the time. And you can watch, go back through wrestling and watch, like, oh, that's because this, like, that show was on at this time, or, like, that movie was really big, and they're biting off a little bit of it. And it's so, you get a small amount of that in other sports, but, like, it has so much more power in the WWE because it's so flexible. Said week to week, you can do a little gimmick like that and have it be very on the pulse of pop culture, and yeah, so much more than you can do in another sport.
Yeah, for sure. And his feud with John Cena, I found really interesting. Partially playing off what I mentioned about John Cena, how he's such a good guy, and like their WrestleMania match was kind of like a one act play. I found that so fascinating. Yeah. And like, it was a well executed match that also, like, I don't know, I can't remember the last time I felt audio was so important to my enjoyment of a match, like in ring audio, and it was very clearly meant to be. And it was again really playing off the idea that we're in an anti-hero culture, and John Cena isn't that, you know, and that's again why people hate John Cena, is because he's not an acceptable part of culture right now. And he certainly wasn't when, in, you know, 2006 to 2010, you know, when Walter White is the king of television type of thing, and Don Draper and that sort of thing, you know? And I really like that they're playing with his good guy image without having him turn heel, you know?
Yeah, it's getting people to hate him while he's just so babyface. Like, it's, yes, in a time where that's not really cool anymore.
And he's so dedicated to furthering WWE as well. Like, he's learning Mandarin so that he can help WWE expand into China.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, he's so for the company. I don't know, he's a really fascinating guy.
Yeah, company man, but good at what he does.
Yeah, I mean, most wrestlers that are as big as he gets, you are a company man, you know?
Yeah, you have to be. And that's one thing I want to get at, is just the amount of control they have over your career. Like, a commissioner of a sport can hate a certain athlete, but unless they're breaking rules, you really can't do anything.
Yeah.
Whereas if you personally offend Vince McMahon at a dinner party, like, you're off the card. It's that. Like,
yeah, exactly. Like,
it's that simple.
That was part of the reason why it took CM Punk so long to become a main eventer, is because he didn't really play the game, and that was part of his image too. And I think what we're getting with Daniel Bryan is a lot of just leftover feelings for CM Punk for when CM Punk won the title, for the first time. And I suspect Daniel Bryan's more of a game player than CM Punk, but yeah, it's a very similar situation.
Yeah, he'd be the people's champ if The Rock didn't already take that title for himself.
Oh God, yeah, for sure. No, Daniel Bryan's not the people's champ; he's the people.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
As I was saying though about Vince kind of controlling your destiny, one of the things, and to add to your point about kind of just thinking about wrestling and when you learning more about it, and it's something you can think about when it's over, and it's a very fascinating subject, is how much control they do have over the results and who does it and like who does well and why. And so with something like, you know, I'll just compare this year's most recent Super Bowl to the WrestleMania we just witnessed. When the Super Bowl was done, basically you can think like, how did that happen? Like, I guess Peyton Manning was overthrowing, or the Seattle defense was really good, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you can break it down a million ways. Like, how did this happen? Whereas when WrestleMania is done, it's why. Why did
yeah.
Daniel Bryan? Like, because it's a choice. It was a bunch of choices culminating in a pay-per-view event. And that's what it is. It's just why. Why did that happen? Why did Vince want that? What are they setting up? Who pissed who off? Who's getting a push? Who's had their last chance? Whose performance wasn't up to par? And, you know, all these questions. And what's going to happen next? And you don't get that in other sports. Like, it kind of, once it's done, it's done. And then we're going to have another event. We're going to have another season, and it's kind of a blank slate. And, you know, you can make DVDs about the Patriots dynasty or whatever, but you never get a full narrative the way that you can explore so deeply and richly in wrestling.
Exactly. Like, you will always get a narrative just because there's so much sports media with, you know, professional sports. But, yeah, with a certain level of control, you know, like every time there's a new game, the narrative has to at least adapt a bit, whereas the matches adapt to the game in WWE, you know?
Yeah,
and the story.
Yeah, and you don't have those outlying events. Like, everything can build to something. You don't have to have those off years in the Pats dynasty, like in wrestling. You can have everything happen for a reason, and everything built to something. And, you know, your champion never has to lose even an inconsequential match, if that's that you want to play it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, AJ Lee just lost the Divas title after, like, what was it, 295 days or something?
Yeah.
And CM Punk, I think, held the title for over a full year.
And, I mean, very topically, yeah, with Ultimate Warrior's extremely recent death, like, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Inducted to the Hall of Fame, went on Raw 2 days later.
He was part of WrestleMania as well.
Yeah, sorry, part of WrestleMania, and then died the next day.
After Raw, yeah.
Yeah, after Raw. And so, I, you know, just thinking about his career, and he was always someone I kind of knew about, but never really was engaged with, never really came up in those retrospectives of the WWE. And the reason is he and Vince just split on bad terms.
Yeah.
And it was just so, it did such a good job of illustrating what place you have in that sport is so dependent on your relationship with Vince. Mm-hmm. And this league controls your legacy way more than any league controls your legacy, because, first of all, they decide your stats.
Yeah.
Like, the first thing is, you know, there's a weird relationship between statistics and popularity in wrestling that doesn't really exist in other sports, because they're so symbiotic. Like, people like you, so you win. So people like you more, so you win more. You know, it's really up to the booker's decision. And whereas other sports, it's kind of like, you know, you do well, some people don't like you still. You know, they're not so closely related. And so not only one is your performance pretty much determined, at least statistically, the WWE loves itself, and they love talking about their history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the superstars of the past. And, you know, Ultimate Warrior won titles, he won a lot of big matches, appeared in a lot of pay-per-views, a lot of WrestleManias, and he kind of just got swept under the rug because he and Vince left on bad terms. And you can see in his 50s, near the end of his life, clearly they decided to bury the hatchet or whatever, and it was just as he was kind of coming back into the fold, and then he died. So it was just, we were going to do this podcast. We had decided before he died, but it would just, it really, really made it clear to me how much your legacy is determined by why you left the sport.
Yeah, for sure.
Sport entertainment product, legally speaking.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get sued if we don't throw that in. Yeah, and I think sort of the, I tried to figure out the core reason why I'm interested in wrestling, and I think the and why I'm still interested in wrestling, even though I'm a much smarter person than I was in the Attitude Era, and I mean everybody gets smarter as time passes, unless I don't know you suffer a traumatic brain injury. But yeah, and I just sort of figured out that I've kind of always loved low culture, like as a child and going further, like even as I become an adult, like I've always loved low culture, but culture is kind of starting to accept low culture. Like Duck Dynasty is the highest rated TV show and stuff like that. And whereas I suppose that's not a respected show, but in the same vein, WWE still doesn't get the respect I feel like it deserves. So it's kind of like this piece of low culture that still allows me to be confused by it because we haven't decided why it's okay. You know, like even when Jersey Shore was a big deal, it was okay for it to be a big deal with people that know better because we were laughing at them, you know?
Yeah.
Culture hasn't settled on a reason why I like wrestling. So I'm still trying to figure that out. And I think one of the biggest reasons why I keep watching wrestling happened on Sunday when the Undertaker's match with Brock Lesnar, when that ended and the total shock on everybody's face was unbelievable. Like it was so incredible. And I think it's just, you might like, that's a very extreme example of something that can happen in wrestling. And it's pretty rare in wrestling and you have to sit through a lot to get to it, but
well, 2 decades in the making, right?
Exactly. And, but even a lesser version of something like that can happen in wrestling. And it's so, so, I don't know, interesting. And it's able to get you on the same guttural level that I love for sports and exciting games, but also with so much more narrative put into it that it kind of is just like, I don't know, it gives you a more satisfying or confused feeling depending on how it ends. And with The Undertaker, it was both. And it was awesome. And yeah. It was so fascinating to watch, you know?
And that's what I meant about the why, not how. Like, when that happened, I was like, what? Why did that? Who decided that? Why? Like, yeah. Why? I just assumed. Like, I would have put money that the streak continued just because.
Oh, you said to me, like, as the Undertaker's walking out, you said something along the lines of, yeah, I'm just going to take 6 minutes to get to the ring for a match I'm definitely not going to lose under any circumstances. And yeah. I was like, I agreed. I was like, yeah, of course he's not going to lose.
Yeah. And as I said about kind of the way the WWE loves itself and loves to market its history and makes a lot of money just selling DVDs of past matches or like career retrospectives. I just assumed that the streak would be an awesome, like they're like, hey, we got this far. This will be a great way to market these DVDs. Like the unbroken streak. And then the streak was broken and everyone was shocked. And yeah. I talked to some people who I know for a fact have not watched a second of wrestling in multiple years. And I was just like, hey, did you watch WrestleMania by any chance? About The Undertaker. Like people just knew about it because even for a constructed streak, like it had just, again, 22 years. Like it's just such a long time.
Well, and The Undertaker's sort of this a very big figure in wrestling, and just because he's been around for so long. And the thing that makes that interesting is that it was definitely his choice to lose. I think that WWE would never have been like, okay, Taker, we're bringing you in for WrestleMania and you're going to lose the match. Like that was his choice. And it was a very clear retirement. And, it was really shocking because I'm sure, the WWE didn't want him to lose. And I think,
how are you so sure of those things?
Because he's, sorry, I guess I'm as sure as I can be, but like, you know, the WWE doesn't, Brock Lesnar winning isn't, I don't know, he's not around very frequently, so doesn't really help the company to write him as the winner as much as it helps to write Undertaker the winner and have him go 22-0. The Undertaker's pretty clearly on his last legs in a way that his past WrestleMania matches in the last couple of years have not looked. He looked much worse, and part of that looks like he was injured pretty early on in the match, is what it looks like. But there's an old wrestling adage that you go out on your back, and the Undertaker's a very big figure. I mean, not literally, but in the backstage, he's very, very highly respected and cares very much about the business. And I think he very strongly believes in the idea that you lose your last match to push the company forward. And that's exactly what he did, because like you said, it became an event. And I think for somebody that respects the mythology of wrestling and respects the athletic achievement involved in it, like The Undertaker, I think he definitely knew that it was his time to check out. And yeah, he wanted to lose his last match because he cares about the tradition of wrestling.
Yeah, and you don't even get the chance to get that long of a streak unless you're willing to be a company man and do those things for the company or the younger guys.
Exactly.
Yeah, and everything I've seen about Undertaker, he is very well respected and an insanely nice person who just does not look like a nice person. Like, he's just a nice guy and stuff. Like, and yeah, he's always talking about helping out the younger guys and everything. So, yeah, I guess I never thought of that, but I guess that is the thing to do, and you only get into that position by doing the things to do. So
yeah, and I think it has been a pretty common theory that Taker came back and was at least at the beginning of this arc was gonna win. Like, he was gonna win, and then I think at some, because he would have had a different opponent than Lesnar, I think, if he was going to lose. Like, it would have made maybe more sense to find somebody that could beat him, that could push the company forward a bit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Cesaro could have really used that push, you know? And yeah, it was just sort of, I think the theory is that his body didn't respond well to training, and he just kind of realized it was his time to get out, you know? And yeah, and then it was changed that he was going to lose. Yeah. And he does love MMA from what I know, and certainly respects Lesnar. I think you could see that in the match as it was going on. But yeah, no, it's fascinating, and yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, then that's the big takeaway from that whole thing. Like, the people really liked Daniel Bryan, that he was doing well, but for kind of pop culture in general, I think it was good to see that it still has that kind of inlet into pop culture, or at least the memory for some people who grew up watching wrestling and still know The Undertaker. Like, it's, I kind of talked about how it's not respected, but you know, for fans, for people, I think, like, it still has a soft spot for a lot of people, and it's why it's continuing to go strong.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll continue to, no matter what we say about it.
And like The Undertaker's streak,
we are over. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. Follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Man. We won't have a podcast next week, but the week following we will be joined by Emily, and we'll be talking about Mean Girls on its 10th anniversary.
So fetch.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.